You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. I'm Mark Klobis, and welcome to the inaugural broadcast of Arguing History, where renowned historians meet to debate some of the key points in our past. This year is the centenary of America's entry into the First World War, an event that radically redefined the world as we know it. But was America's participation in it necessary? To discuss this question of whether the United States should have entered the war in 1917, we have joining us today two eminent historians. Hello, everyone. I'm Mark Klobis, and welcome to the inaugural broadcast of Arguing History, where renowned historians meet to debate some of the key points in our past. This year is the centenary of America's entry into the First World War, an event that radically redefined the world as we know it. But was America's participation in it necessary? To discuss this question of whether the United States should have entered the war in 1917, we have joining us today two eminent historians of the conflict. The first is Michael Nyberg, who is the Stimson Chair of the Department of National Security and Strategy at the U.S. Army War College and the author of numerous books about the conflict, including The Path to War, How the First World War Created Modern America, and Dance of the Furies, Europe and the Outbreak of World War I. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
We're happy to have you. The second is Brian Newman of the U.S. Army Center for Military History and the lead editor of their Centenary series of pamphlets on the war. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. So, the question today is, should the United States have entered the First World War? And I throw the question open to both of you. Gentlemen?
Well, I guess my first response would be that I'm not sure that I see my role as an historian to look back 100 years and try to judge what people did a century ago from the position that I sit in now. We know now where all this leads. We know that the First World War is going to break the world in a way that's going to lead to a Great Depression, a Second World War, a Holocaust, I would argue a Cold War, I would argue still some of what we're dealing with in the Middle East. What Americans were feeling in 1917 was a sense that their 3 years of neutrality from 1914 to 1917 had made them less safe, not more. So in my mind, the question is not so much, should we have entered the First World War? The question in my mind is, what other options did Americans see in the spring of 1917? And as I've argued in the book, I don't think they saw many options by April of 1917.
Brian?
I think that, again, I agree with Mike in the idea that it's probably not for us to necessarily judge. Or to rethink the past with the benefit of hindsight. I think one of the ways that I was approaching it was, if you ask, should they have gone into the war, then it brings in Mike's idea of options, but then what were the reasons, you know, what were the economic issues? What were the political issues? What were the diplomatic issues? What was the United States trying to accomplish? And from my mind, I think that there's definitely some debatable points about whether or not the United States' decision to go to war was really reflective of the reality of the situation that they faced.
I'd like to take a step back here for just a moment, and I apologize if I'm misrepresenting what the two of you are saying here, but both of you are making it seem as though that there was not really an option for war about whether or not to go to war in April of 1917. And I was wondering if you could perhaps unpack as to why there wasn't a choice. I mean, Michael, you've already explained how the Americans had this perception that that they were less safe after 3 years, 2.5 years of war than more safe. And yet at the same time, that the devil's advocate position, if you will, is that Americans were not necessarily all that enthused about going to war.
I would absolutely agree with that characterization. I don't think Americans are enthused for war in the spring of 1917 at all. I think they see themselves as having run out of options. And I can talk about this as much as you want, but there are three events in the spring of 1917. One is the Russian Revolution, which takes the Tsar out of the equation and allows Wilson to actually make the statement that this could be a war to make the world safer democracy, that just as the American Civil War began over secession and ended up liberating and emancipating slaves, so too could World War I produce something positive. And that's a very short bit of that. The Zimmerman telegram, which is a direct threat to the United States, as is the Declaration of Unrestricted Submarine Warfare. So what I mean is that by April of 1917, Americans have concluded that they're in a much worse position than they had been a few months or a few years earlier. So I would argue they don't enter the war with enthusiasm. They enter the war with determination. And your point about options is well taken. There are a lot of routes and a lot of paths that the United States could have taken. In my view, the route that the American people take and the route that their president take are different. That is, Wilson really does have an idea, as expressed in the 14 points, to create a brand new world, to create a new world order, to reshape the world in America's image. Whereas I think most Americans wanted to get rid of that situation where the war was increasingly encroaching on their own sense of security. So that, not to put too fine a point on this, so that by November 11th, 1918, when the German army lays down its arms and agrees to an armistice, most Americans think they've done what they came into the war to do, but their president wanted to continue on, which is what creates all that controversy about the League of Nations, Treaty of Versailles, and all of that. So options were certainly there in April 1917. There was not a clear articulation of what the end state was and whether the American people and their president were agreed on that.
I think, to expand upon that, you know, one of the things I was thinking of in terms of options was, you know, Wilson had a very clear option that it might have been naive, but William Jennings Bryan, Secretary of State, who resigned over the issue, said if the Americans want to be neutral, then we should not be sending American citizens into a war zone. Don't put them at risk. Wilson rejected that idea based upon his idea that America, as a neutral power, had the right to do what it to be safe. Well, there's the idealist Wilson who thinks, you know, this is a matter of honor, and then there's the reality of, well, that's great, but, you know, honor's not going to protect you in the middle of a war zone. So I think that was what I was thinking, was that, you know, Wilson could have pulled the United States back completely, banned all travel to the war zone, but he didn't do that.
Sure, there were options on the table. The United States could have done a naval contribution only to the war. There were issues being discussed. Should the United States declare war only on Germany or on all of the Central Powers? Wilson's, the decision the American people and their president take is a declaration of war against Germany only. And so all of these debates are revealing, I think, of what the American people think they're trying to do and what the problem is that they're trying to solve.
If I may draw upon a point to which both of you have been referring, you bring up this issue about not letting Americans go into the war zone, and that gets to this this pre-war context, which we have been addressing only in passing so far. And I want to perhaps take a step back and illuminate that, which is the fact that the United States was not, the 12th man, if you will, who was kind of sitting in the bleachers just watching events. I mean, they were already involved at a very real level. And so that raises another interesting question. To what degree does that involvement really foreclose or a lot of these choices? Not just a matter of say, sending men into war, but to what degree does America's financial involvement, which famously came under fire in the 1930s, or America's economic involvement really, effectively make it, give them much less options by even 1916, let alone 1917?
Mind if I start on that one?
Go for it.
I think that it definitely that the increasing American economic connections to definitely the Allied powers gave the United States much more of a vested interest in who won the war. But again, I don't think that it made the Americans much more likely to become involved, but it definitely tied us closer to the Allies. You're starting to get into the idea that we go to war to save the Allies, and that is certainly not the case. We're no big fan of the Allies.
I would agree with that. The United States gets involved in the war, and this is under discussion from the very first days in 1914 for American interests. It's just that the American people can't agree on what those interests are. And just the only other point that I would raise is that the United States, if economics was the only issue, then continuing neutrality is actually the best option. And when we think about that debate of the 1930s that you mentioned, we think about the multi-billionaires, we think of the J.P. Morgans, we think of the financiers. But it is the case that everybody in the United States is making money. Per capita income in the United States goes up almost 70% between 1914 and 1917. If all you want to do is protect that continuing economic growth, then neutrality is the right answer. The problem for the American people, and you can see it in Sunday sermons, you can see it in newspaper editorials, you can see it all across the country, is this sense that the American people have that if our only relationship to this war is to make money off of it, then what does that say about us? What does that say about the role of the United States in the world and who we want to be on the world stage? And that's a very uncomfortable question for Americans to answer. And I think what happens in the 1930s, that debate is really about the 1930s. It's not about the First World War period.
Yeah, and I think to add on that to that is, today it's very easy to talk about Wilson the idealist, but also Wilson the naivete of Wilsonianism and so on and so forth. But and to look at when people talk about things like ideals and promoting values, today it seems kind of quaint and it's just rhetoric. But I don't think that you can really say that about Wilson. And I think that he is really trying to, especially in his 14 points and particularly in his address to Congress on April 2nd, that he is really laying out a moral argument for why we need to do this. And I think that he's speaking to what Mike is talking about, where he is trying to explain to the public, why this is a good thing to do. We don't want to do it, but it's the right thing to do, rather. It is a moral effort. It's a moral cause, and that's what we're trying to achieve. And I think that those beliefs were sincere.
But I wanted to tie this back into a point that Michael was making. It's a dimension that we probably haven't addressed yet, which is that it's not just about America's intentions and America's goals, but also perceptions of America's role. Because at the beginning, Michael, you drew in the issue of the Zimmerman telegram. And that gets, I think, it raises this issue as to why you had the Zimmerman telegram, which was when Germany was trying to get Mexico to attack the United States in 1917. And this idea as to whether or not Germany at some point just makes this conclusion that America is a hostile power and therefore, you know, basically, you know, makes that into a reality by virtue of their actions stemming from that premise. And to what degree then do we see that as perhaps what, you know, in effect tips us from making this rational decision that the United States can stay out of this conflict, as terrible as it is, even though we might have moral imperatives to get involved, versus saying, well, at some point a fight is being picked with us, and so we're going to have to step in.
Yeah, in my view, that's exactly what, you know, that's what it is. That's really what it is. Most Americans, I don't think, cared about the morality of Woodrow Wilson. Many Americans disagreed strongly with the morality of Woodrow Wilson. But what begins to happen from 1914 to 1917 is, again, this sense that by being neutral, we've made ourselves less safe. We've created a situation where Germany can make an as outrageous a proposal as the Zimmermann telegram suggested, which says that if the United States declares war on us, we, Germany, want you, Mexico, to invade the southwest of the United States. We'll give you back Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico. And oh, by the way, talk to the Japanese about coming into this alliance as well. So, you know, and with California as the lure, it's not stated in the Zimmermann telegram, but that's the lure. And the other thing that's playing in American minds is if the British and or the French find themselves at the breaking point, one way they could get out of the war at relatively minimal cost is to give up their Atlantic and Caribbean possessions. So you could be looking at a post-war world in which you have a German-Mexican-Japanese alliance aimed at the United States, while at the same time, a peace treaty could give Martinique, Halifax, Vancouver, you let your imagination run as far as you want, going from the British and French over to the Germans. So just to put not too fine a point on this again, the United States took a lot of action in the 1916. We bought the Danish Virgin Islands from Denmark to keep them out of German hands. We started seriously planning for the defense of Puerto Rico. So this is all being done out of this fear that the world is crouching in on us. And as you noted, that means this war is not really about morality at all. It is about the most justified reason of all, and that is national self-defense. And again, this is why I think the idea of going to war in April 1917 for self-defense is not controversial. The idea of going to war to remake the entire world in America's image, that is controversial.
Now, in terms of self-defense, would you more say that it is what we're starting to see is American foreign policy in the 19th century was essentially just protect the Monroe Doctrine, and the ones who essentially enforced that were the British. Sure. As the British are becoming less or becoming weaker, now the Germans are starting to encroach upon that. So is it really going to war, or wouldn't theoretically the Defense Act of 1916 would have solved that by providing the American naval ability to protect the Western Hemisphere?
A big thing that's in the American public discourse in 1916 and even in a little bit into early 1917 is that America risks the fate that China suffered, a rich country, a wealthy country that lacked the ability to defend itself, so that it eventually gets picked apart by the European great powers. And the fear is that either the World War is going to produce a situation where one country is ridiculously more powerful than the others, or it's going to produce a situation where one or more of those countries need to find a way to recover their economy and build their economy back up at the end of the war. And the logical place for those states to do that is going to be in the United States. So you're right, you get a bigger navy out of this. And of course, 1914 is when the Panama Canal gets built. But there's still the issue of the army. There's still the issue of the overall kind of preparedness and industrial preparedness of the United States. And it's all part of this fear that what the First World War has done is made this country less safe, not because we were doing anything nefarious, but because we weren't alert to the danger that was coming until it was too late.
So it's almost, I keep thinking about when we were talking about the Zimmermann telegram and talking about the Japanese and Mexico. And I mean, it almost makes me think of, you know, Reagan era and, you know, the Nicaraguan army is going to be marching up across the southern border. I mean, how realistic do you think that the people actually thought these proposals were?
Well, what I think happens, and I think, you know, if you think about the Nicaraguan army, translate that into the much more powerful German army, and you can get a sense of where this fear is coming from. There's a series of teenage fiction books about a German invasion of the United States. People like Theodore Roosevelt, I mean, it goes all the way to Theodore Roosevelt, are worried about this. What I think is the case is that it's easy for many Americans, especially in the kind of center and left in the United States, to dismiss this as you know, Roosevelt just off his rocker, as the, you know, people, militarists trying to stir up trouble, which is what people are saying in 1916. Then when the Zimmermann telegram comes out, I mean, that is the smoking gun. That is proof positive that the Germans really do want to do this. So after the Zimmermann telegram, it becomes really, really difficult, even for socialists and pacifists in the United States, to kind of wave off the German threat to the United States. Now the question becomes, how do you deal with that threat? And that's obviously a very different debate.
But to what degree can you say – go ahead, Brian.
I was going to say, you know, when we're talking about this, it seems like the American people are on one page because they're talking about the fear, and then the policymakers, I think that they see the threat, but I think from my reading is that the German actions in terms of the submarine campaign was a far more dangerous threat and a far more realistic and prevalent threat to American interests versus what maybe the Germans are going to try and do. I mean, you know, I mean, as much as I was. Don't want to be dismissive of the Mexican army. I'm going to be dismissive of the Mexican army. I understand the public fear, whether or not that's based in actual reality and in a realistic fear.
Well, remember too that this is a time period when Mexico was what we would call a failed state. I mean, it has a revolution in 1911. It doesn't get a constitution until 1917. I mean, all stuff I know, Brian, that you know full well. So Pancho Villa claimed that the Germans were backing his raid into New Mexico. There were certainly some very aggressive German spies working out of Mexico. So the question isn't so much that the Mexican army is going to march through Texas and Arizona. The question is, what if Germany wins the war and then it is Germany that sets this new world order? Is that something that America can live with? If the new world order is German conquest over Britain, France, and Russia, while at the same time forming alliances with Mexico and Japan, is that a world that's in America's interest? And I think by the spring of 1917, the easy answer is no.
And I think you can see in terms of back to the question of should the United States have gone to war, you know, American interests in the 19-teens, as Mike said, it, from an economic standpoint, it would have been fine if the U.S. maintained its neutrality because our economic interests were one within the Americas, but also Asia. We were looking to expand, and truthfully, we're expanding economy, and the weaker the Europeans get, the better. I think that the question now arises with in terms of who's going to lead the international community. I think the American position is better the devil you know in terms of the British versus what looks like a truly aggressive upstart who may not be content to allow everybody else a piece of the tape or a piece of the pie, so to speak, as well.
But the Pax Britannica works for the United States. The Pax Britannica is a kind of control of the commons, not unlike what the United States Navy is doing today to keep the system flowing. If Germany it wins the war and wants to upset that apple cart, then the United States has to deal with a completely new international reality that clearly won't be to its advantage.
Mm-hmm. But to what degree is that calculation being made among the American population? I mean, you could see it among, say, strategists. You could see it among businessmen. You can see it among people that are involved in the international economy that's developed. But to what degree are, say, American voters in Colorado or Alabama or, if you want to be a bit more controversial, Minnesota? Where you have a very heavy German ethnic presence, are they engaged with the issues at that level versus say a more elemental level? And here what pops in my mind is what Dalton Trumbo writes in Johnny Got His Gun. And granted, he's writing with the benefit of hindsight, but he's conveys this idea that the American people, we're sort of reading about this in the newspapers, and it was something that was happening across the moat in Europe and wasn't really something that they weren't thinking in terms of trade or economics.
Well, no, but they certainly see wheat prices rising, cotton prices rising, hog prices rising. They certainly understand what it means to their pocketbook. They certainly understand what it means to their community's growth. I mean, the statistics are in the book, but I mean, the United States has a net negative trade balance with Europe when the war broke out. Within weeks, that has flipped to a net positive trade balance. And you don't need to be a macroeconomist to understand what that means. You don't need to have an investment in a global trade firm to understand the way that that's happening. And another reason I think the Zimmerman telegram is so important is that it does make the point that the war is no longer about what's happening on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. It is now very much about what's happening in your country itself. And the American people did fully understand what this war was doing to them economically. And I didn't mention this earlier, but it's worth saying. I mean, there were a lot of Americans who were manufacturing things that Americans used to buy from Europe that people were now buying from American manufacturers because the war was making it impossible to get those things in Europe. And they include things like eyeglasses and pencils and Bibles, all of which Americans had typically bought from Europe before World War I. I found a report when I was doing research for the book about the American Bible sales groups and how happy they were that American Bible sales were just shooting through the roof because Americans couldn't get those items from Europe anymore. Bible salesmen in Europe, Bible manufacturers, were now using their printing capabilities to print military forms and whatever else it was that the armies needed. So it's not just that you're selling stuff to the Europeans, it's that you are using American markets to replace the old European markets.
And the... the American economy is expanding by leaps and bounds. I think I don't remember the exact numbers, but we do go from a debtor to a creditor, and we supplant the British as the largest creditor nation in the world. Kind of the global banking system or center shifts for a period from London to New York City, and which is good for the American economy, but with the as the economy is adjusting and as things become uncertain for the like the farmer in Wisconsin, they're not sure what all this means, and that leads to uncertainty and fear.
Let me approach this question then from a different perspective. So, if I may summarize, basically, both of you are arguing that the United States in the spring of 1917 did not have a practical alternative to participating in the war, given their perception of security, correct? Their concerns about their security, correct?
Yeah, I would actually go a step further, and I do in the book, in saying that the American people are pushing their president more than their president is pushing them. So as soon as the Zimmerman telegram comes out, the city of Philadelphia, the state of New York, the state of Massachusetts, they all consider that the United States is at war. They mobilize National Guards. They mobilize militias. People are writing letters to the editor saying, what are we waiting for? Two members of Wilson's cabinet considered resigning because they were afraid that the Senate might declare war without Wilson. So, you know, it's not the case that this story necessarily has to be centered on Woodrow Wilson. This is a fear that's going across the United States.
And, but at the same time, there is a public fear. And I think one of the things that we're struggling with, and that we've actually, we as historians have been struggling with since, April 7th of 1917, is that, unlike World War II, obviously Pearl Harbor, proximate cause. There is no real clear proximate cause, I think, that says the United States had no other options. It did. It could have chosen not to. But I mean, whether the people, but you get this with the entire war going back to 1914. This is such a complicated war, and that you have the mass hysteria of the public versus the kind of the great game of international politics and international relations, jockeying for position. How do you control the public? So it just gets into. There are no real clean answers, so to speak, when dealing with the First World War, as opposed to some later wars, I think.
The question I wanted to throw out, though, is this. At what point does entering that war become more rather than less likely? Is it with the Zimmerman telegram? Is it with the resumption of unrestricted U-boat warfare? Is it with something more nebulous in terms of this imperceptible shift in anxiety of the American people? At what point do we go towards, he kept us out of war being a popular appeal to, we must get in this war while we can still make a difference?
Well, I mean, I think the point we've made a few times is obviously right. There were always options. There were always other things that could have been done. But by early 1917, those options are narrowing considerably. And there are plenty of Americans. Even Wilson understood it. Wilson didn't much care for that "he kept us out of war" slogan. In fact, he said how much he disliked it because he knew that the ball wasn't really in his court. As he said to the Secretary of the Navy, that any German lieutenant can get us into this war at any minute. So there's an awareness among Wilson and his advisors that the options for the United States are narrowing. And again, what happens in the spring of 1917, the resumption of unrestricted submarine warfare means more Americans are going to be killed. And it means that the last 2 years of Wilson's diplomacy goes right out the window. The Zimmerman telegram has Americans really genuinely terrified and angry. And the Russian Revolution opens up possibilities for those people who want to believe that the war, as Wilson himself said it, that if war is sin, this might be the redemption, that Russia and then Germany become democratic societies, and then you can get a Europe full of democratic societies. This is the origin of that notion of democratic peace theory, that democracies don't fight wars with one another. So you could argue that it's fear. You could also argue that there's a certain sense of hope. And again, to get back to the first point that you raised, it's difficult for us to do that now and see the world the way that people 100 years ago saw it.
Mm-hmm. To answer your question, the question about was there kind of a point where it became really, really difficult? I think once the Germans resumed unrestricted sub warfare, it was just a matter of time. The Zimmerman telegram obviously sparked the public imagination. But I really think that once the Germans resumed that process or that technique, it's only a matter of time. And in fact, Wilson is waiting to see whether or not the Germans are actually going to kill Americans at sea. Once they do, it's really, that's kind of the decision is made. And he's kind of pulled, as Mike is saying, it's really not up to him. The Germans make the decision to resume unrestricted sub-warfare, and then they start carrying it out. And at that point, Wilson's hands are tied.
And yet they're not, for a reason that you guys were pointing out earlier, which was that, they could have, theoretically said, okay, no more American ships can travel to Europe, basically a ban on travel. Those options never seem to have come into play. There does seem to be the sense of, well, the Germans have made their decision, and it's almost the active response is to sort of accept that war is coming.
Well, the argument from Theodore Roosevelt and others would be that the United States had done exactly what you suggest for 2 years. That since the Lusitania, mm-hmm. the United States had gone soft on the Germans, and look what it's gotten us. It's gotten us the Zimmerman telegram, the resumption of unrestricted submarine warfare, the potential defeat of Britain and France. Again, that the 2 years between the Lusitania and the outbreak of the First World War for the United States created a far worse situation, and that the longer you wait, the worse it's going to get. So, yes, there were options, but the options look a lot worse. That war looks like it's a terrible option, but to the eyes of Roosevelt, Leonard Wood, I would argue the vast majority of Americans by April 1917, all of those other options had made you more exposed, not less. So that's what I meant when I don't think the American people went to war with enthusiasm. They went to war with a sense of determination.
Well, and I think that the United States had pulled back, had not gone to war after the Lusitania. The Germans, they make the Sussex Pledge in the spring of 1916, and they essentially hold to it for 10 months, or I think. My math might be a little off, or 9 months. But now the Germans have gone back on their word. So the Americans have given the Germans every opportunity to not show themselves to be the aggressor, not show themselves to be the danger, not show themselves to be the threat to international security and international peace. And the Germans just throw it out the window. They're untrustworthy. You cannot trust them to hold to their agreements. And you can't trust them not to do something crazy like reach out to. I mean, it's just baffling to think that Zimmerman actually admitted that he sent the telegram. It's just that the Germans are February, March of 1917, the Germans are just obviously the aggressor, obviously out of control, obviously have no respect for international norms, international mores. So there's really no point. I mean, it's the rabid dog that has to be put down.
And, you know, Mark, you mentioned German Americans, too. And, you know, this is there's a transition that German Americans go through. So that in 1914, German Americans are arguing largely for neutrality, for keeping the United States at a distance from this conflict. By 1917, by late 1916, you see even German Americans, people like Oswald Billard and Edward Rumley, who are making the case that it's not the Germans we need to worry about, but it is the Prussians. It is this regime that we need to worry about. So you get these arguments for what we would today call regime change that come out really clearly in Wilson's Declaration of War speech, in which he says several times, we're not going to war with the German people. We're doing this to help the German people. We're going to get rid of that awful government they have so that the German people themselves can realize the full potential of what they are. And now that to the French and British sounds incredibly naive, but it rings true even with many German Americans in the United States, most of whom, incidentally, are not Prussian, and most of whom don't necessarily have all that warm feelings for the German regime. These are men like Dwight Eisenhower, Eddie Rickenbacker, John Pershing, all of whom are German American, but clearly understand their American identity as being more important.
I want to go back now to a point that was made earlier in our conversation, which is this idea as to how, in many ways, American economic interests especially were being better served by neutrality. Now, I don't want to get too counterfactual here, but I do want to raise this question as to go back to the question which both of you have suggested is you know, a very problematic one, which is, should the United States have entered the First World War, which is, to what degree might American interests in the aggregate have been better served by, you know, in effect, going against this tide and having, say, a Wilson saying, you know, even with this, we're just going to stay out of it because we just choose not to participate in what's taking place. To what degree might America have been better off staying out of the war? Given the benefit of hindsight,
we should we should get Niall Ferguson on the line.
Well, I mean, you know, there's two ways to answer your question. One is to take it with the knowledge that we have a century on, which, you know, to my mind, the answer is not so much do you or do you not go into the war. The answer is how do you structure a peace that will actually work? And here you're getting into the difference between what America wanted to get out of the peace and how Wilson handled himself. Here, Wilson does have to be in the center of the story. But the second question is, what were Americans talking about in the spring of 1917? And those are not the terms of the debate. The terms of the debate are, by inaction, we have put ourselves in a position where we could endanger our security, our children's security, our grandchildren's security. And that's the problem that we have to solve. So I think you really are talking about two different kinds of questions when you ask whether the United States could or should have taken a different route in April of 1917.
That raises go ahead,
and,
Brian.
You know, I think that if the conflict had maintained had contained itself to the European sphere, that if the Germans didn't look like they were going to expand into where American interests were dedicated, that, you know, perhaps the United States would have been fine to sit back and start ramping up and continue to ramp up its economy. But you know, it's really difficult to argue one way or the other.
But both of you are raising a very interesting point that we've been talking about in passing, which is the degree to which the war coincides with this, with what both of you are pointing to as this growing American awareness of its role in the world. You mentioned, Brian, how you know, the 19th century, I think it was you, Brian, about how in the 19th century there was this Monroe Doctrine, which was essentially a British-enforced Monroe Doctrine. But now in the 20th century, the United States is no longer willing to just issue proclamations. They're increasingly thinking, well, if we want this, we have to engage and make it happen.
Well, I think you're seeing just the process of the expansion of American reach in terms of international affairs. I mean, the United States has always been an expansionist nation, and by 1917, what we'd had the Philippines for just under two decades, we'd had Hawaii for what, three decades, I believe. Check my math on that, but so we're seeing a slow, very slow expansion of American interests abroad. And now the United States, and one of the things that, as Mike had said, one of the things that had enabled that was the Pax Britannica. Now we're starting to see a challenge of that, and you see the American position, which had been a slow but steady increase over the past half century. Now you see a real question about, okay, if the system that has enabled us to expand is now under threat, what's going to happen after that? And that's where we really get into, we have a vested interest in who wins this war.
And we know what comes next, but in 1917, of course, they did not. And there were any one of a number of possibilities: a German victory on the Western Front that leads to a Pax Germanica, the possibility of later on in 1917, the possibility of the Bolshevik Revolution spreading worldwide. I mean, we know where this ends, and we know how bloody right. that road is. Of course, they did not. And it's important to underscore that this is what I mean when I say it's difficult to look back with what we know, because you have to understand the world that they're seeing. And to many Americans, and you see this from late 1914 on, it looks like Europe is tearing itself apart, that Europe is not going to be in a position to be the leader of the world. And there's a lot of Americans, Roosevelt is the loudest voice among this, saying, look, if it's not going to be the Europeans, it should be us. We are the ones ready to do this. It's just that Wilson and Roosevelt and many other Americans had this debate about exactly how that should play out and exactly what the new world ought to look like.
Yeah, and you know, we should also remember that we do have, in fact, the increase of the Japanese,
yes.
who were definitely seen as an up and coming challenger, as a threat in Asia, which is the, you know, almost the great prize is, you know, what are the positions going to be in East Asia?
That aspect of America's engagement with the world sometimes feels as though it's being left out of a lot of this, a lot of the works that have been written about the war. They treat it as sort of this tripolarity: America's relations with Britain as a nation, America's relations with Germany as a nation, how Americans were responding to the war. And yet what both of you are pointing to is the fact that there was this dimension of America was beginning to find its place as a global power, and that was a very much of a real consideration in terms of this question of whether or not America joins the war on whichever side.
There's no question about that. The debate is how to exercise that power. So you have people like Wilson who want the United States, William Howard Taft is another one, who want the United States engaged in creating international organizations and creating global institutions that will reduce the overall threat of war and increase the chances of prosperity. Then you get folks like Roosevelt and Henry Cabot Lodge who argue, well, no, that's not the way the international system actually functions. And the best thing for the United States, and by extension the best thing for the world, is if the United States exercises its power independent of those organizations. And that's a debate that existed before World War I, but it's on the margins. by 1917, 1918, 1919, it's at the center of what Americans are talking about and what they're debating. And that's why the Treaty of Versailles is so controversial. The question isn't whether or not the United States will be playing a bigger role on the world stage. Everybody agrees that it will. The question is, what kind of a role ought it to play, and what should America's interest be? What should we be pursuing?
Which kind of gets into the misperception of the 1920s and the 1930s, the misperception of what does it mean when the United States rejects Versailles? It doesn't. This idea that we just withdrew behind the confines of the Atlantic and the Pacific is completely false. The United States is still an international player, and they're expanding. It's just, in what format are they doing that? Are they doing it within the confines of the League of Nations, or are they continuing to play this power politics of looking for their own interests?
Yeah, it's slightly more idealistic, I think. I mean, you know, the United States, the argument, whether it's true or not, whether it's hypocritical or not, the argument people like Lodge are making is that not only does the United States benefit from a greater expansion of American power, but the world benefits from an expansion of American power. And of course, that argument is not limited to the 1920s. That argument is something that you hear today as well. So one of the things that, you know, about the First World War that to me is so interesting is this basic framing of the debate. Should the United States participate in the world through international organizations, or should it be allowed to operate the way that it wants to in the international arena for its own good and for the world's good? That's a debate that we've been having ever since.
Right. And obviously continue on today. I mean, Paris. Yeah, Paris was a classic example. Well, the country is still going to benefit if the United States is in the lead. Well, but we can. That's for another show.
And that, I think it's interesting, though, in what is different from the debate today versus the debate that takes place a century ago, which is that a century ago, though America is this emerging power, both of you are pointing to this degree of insecurity in the sense of. Not so much insecurity out of a sense of both of you point to the fear that was felt, but also the uncertainty. America has never really exerted this role on this scale, and it faces these very threatening powers with a very hostile interest to America's sphere of influence. You have Germany. You mentioned Japan, which was. Technically an ally during the war, but there does seem to be this question that America's never really taken on a struggle of that caliber. And there is this question that both you seem to be hinting at, which is America doesn't know necessarily how well it will do in that scenario.
Well, I don't think that they have any idea how well they'll do. This is something that, that I've raised in some of our work on the army. When we actually get into the war, none of these guys know what they're doing. This is very new, a new experience in terms of how do you play on. I mean, you know, this is the United States playing on the big stage. The greatest previous international kind of crisis that we'd had was 20 years ago when you had essentially a third-rate power beating up on a fifth-rate power, which during the Spanish-American War. Now we have a seat at the grown-ups table, so to speak, and they don't necessarily know how to do this.
This aspect of sort of America.
You guys have been cutting in and out, so I apologize.
Oh. Sorry about that, Mike.
I don't know if it's my Wi-Fi link or what, but you guys, there was a little bit of cutting in and out there, so I don't want to walk over Brian, but is it okay if I add something there?
Please do.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, you know, militarily, I think Brian's absolutely right. They don't know what they're doing, even though many of them aren't conscious of it. But at the meta level, I mean, I hate to keep coming back to Theodore Roosevelt, but he exemplifies this very muscular notion that the United States does know what it's doing. It'll have to figure it out, but that the Europeans have obviously shown that they can't do it. And on the other end of that scale, you know, Wilson thinks this as well. It's just more of a kind of moral vision that Wilson is trying to lay out. So there are plenty of Americans already talking about an American century, already talking about replacing Europe, already talking about reshaping the world, either in America's image or to America's advantage. But either way, they are aware that they're going to come out of this war in relatively a much stronger position than when they went out of it. The question is what to do with that power.
Mm-hmm. So to what degree do we then perhaps miss or overlook or understate this aspect of it in 1917? Because we do present it in terms of unrestricted U-boat warfare, Zimmermann telegram, and yet we seem to have really kind of disconnected it from this debate that's been taking place that both of you are referring to, and that really does reflect the sense that it goes back to the point that both of you raised at the very beginning, that it really wasn't a question of, you know, should the United States get into the war. In a sense, this change that was taking place in America's position in the world made such an engagement, for lack of a more precise word, inevitable.
Yeah, again, I think I'd highlight it wasn't inevitable, though I think it's increasingly more likely. The question, again, is what do you want to do? And one of the hinge points of this, of course, is the League of Nations, should the U.S. belong to it or not. Another hinge point is whether the United States ought to assume control over parts of the old Ottoman and Austro-Hungarian empires, which Wilson is adamant that the United States won't do. And the Europeans are trying best they can to say, look, you keep criticizing us for what we're doing in the colonies and for what we're doing in empire. Take a role, take part of Turkey, take part of Anatolia, take Armenia, take control of these regions and see if you really can do any better. And it's Wilson's adamant refusal to do it that just exasperates the Europeans, that you want to be on playing a role on the stage, but you don't really want to take any responsibility. So this to me is all part of this debate, and Brian was getting at it. You know, what do you think you want to do, and do you think you're qualified to do it? And that's where I think some of the insecurity Brian was indicating is coming out of, that to criticize the Europeans is one thing. To jump in and actually try to govern a place like Armenia, that's something completely different.
You know, and it's interesting if you look at, you know, when you look at Versailles and you look at Wilson's, well, I would not necessarily say abject failure, but he did not, you know, he's
lack of success.
He's thinking, lack of success, and it's also that I think from Wilson's point of view, he thinks everybody should agree with him. And to what Mike said is, they said, and their argument was, well, okay, then show us you can do it. Show us leadership. Show us that you know that you can actually operate on this stage. And we've been doing this for centuries. And this is how it's been. And Wilson is trying to rewrite the international system. Well, that you're going to have to get a whole lot of buy-in, and you don't get it from the Europeans. They'll go some of the ways, but they're not going to just throw out the entire system that has benefited them.
Yeah, to Brian's point, there's a wonderful anecdote when David Lloyd George is criticized in the House of Commons for not doing better for Britain in the peace treaty. He's supposed to have responded, "I don't think I did too bad, considering I was sitting between Napoleon and Jesus Christ himself." And Jesus Christ himself is Wilson, of course, coming up with these, you know, grand ideas. Georges Clemenceau, the Napoleon of that anecdote, the French premier, when Clemenceau first saw the 14 points, he said God himself was content to give us just 10. So there is this sense that the Americans really don't have any clue about the way that Europe is really organized. And, you know, I used to do this with undergrads all the time when I taught the 14 points and the Treaty of Versailles. I would walk in and say, "Where is the president of the United States today?" And the point is that nobody knows. He could be in China. He could be in Africa. And no one would think of it as unusual. Wilson was the first American president to leave the United States while in office. It was an enormous deal that he had done that. And then he goes to Europe and tries to tell the Europeans the way they should organize their society. And then he's surprised when they're unhappy with his proposals.
It's also that, you know, go ahead, Brian.
And it's really remarkable that Wilson never went to Europe during the war.
Right.
He doesn't go until after. And Wilson has this level of detachment from what is actually going on. He doesn't have personal relationships with these men. You know, he doesn't have, so he is a true outsider coming in to this system. And I think it's, I mean, it's just really kind of remarkable if you look at the American effort. You know, you have men like John J. Pershing and Tasker Bliss, who are operating essentially, I mean, from a military standpoint, they're having to do diplomacy. They're essentially acting like a chief of state, which, because Wilson is remaining back in the United States. So it's a very alien, or a very strange position when Wilson comes in, because he is truly an outsider.
Or contrast it to what Franklin Roosevelt does in the Second World War. And part of this, I understand, is technological. It's easier for Roosevelt to move around than it was for Wilson. But a large part of it is attitudinal. It's the way that Roosevelt wants to conduct strategy. It's the way he wants to do things. And his style is just night and day different from what Wilson is trying to do. In part, I think, because Roosevelt understood better than Wilson did, as Brian said, that you have to get buy-in, that the United States, as powerful as it is not in a position to just say, look, we're reorienting the world, this is how it's going to be, get on our backs. And Roosevelt understood much better than Wilson did that you couldn't create something out of clay, that you had to deal with the situation as it was in existence.
I mean, you know, Wilson almost goes out of his way, he goes out of his way to keep the United States separate. And we are not a member of the alliance. We're an associated power. So we are going to fight the war, and he gives Pershing essentially carte blanche to fight the war in the way he wants. Now Pershing recognizes begrudgingly that he needs the French and the British to help build up the American military effort or support the American military effort. But Pershing essentially has the authority to do whatever he wants to do if it serves American interests, and to reject the Allied positions if that does not serve America, the end of America, or does not serve American interests.
Very famously, when Wilson came to France to begin the negotiations, the French wanted to take him to the First World War battlefield so that he could see what the Germans had done to France with his own eyes. And Wilson quite famously created an enormous scandal by refusing to go. And it's the most simple, basic political act that one can do. So from the very beginning of the conference, he and the French, and then later he and the British, are just not seeing the world in quite the same terms. And Brian was reluctant to use the phrase abject failure, but I'd be willing to go there. The performance of Wilson at the Paris Peace Conference is abysmal on more than one level.
I was thinking it's a bit unfair in a sense to compare Wilson to Roosevelt, because Roosevelt had the benefit of Wilson's example to build upon. He knew in a way how not to do it, and that Roosevelt, who himself had gone to Europe during the First World War, probably appreciated that direct engagement during the conflict a lot better than Wilson did, who really had no previous example. I mean, the only other real example of a presidential intervention on that scale was Theodore Roosevelt in the Russo-Japanese War, and he had the participants come to him. He played this this position of being an arbiter, and ultimately it was one in which, you know, he could do because the United States was not a participant. Wilson, by contrast, had only that, and he was trying to have it without really acknowledging that it was a different situation. Britain and France were not prostrate and dependent upon the U.S. the way they would be in 1945, and that Wilson basically was sort of making it up as he went along in that respect.
Well, I'm not a political or presidential historian, but I mean, I feel pretty safe in concluding that Franklin Roosevelt was simply the better politician of the two. And the more I look at Woodrow Wilson, especially in the war years, the more I see a weak politician who's trying to balance both sides, trying to balance his critics to one side and his critics to the other side. And he's trying to find a way forward. And you have to remember, Wilson won the 1912 election only because of a split in the Republican Party. And he won the 1916 election by the narrowest margin in American history until 2000. So this is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a uniformly popular president as Franklin Roosevelt was. So there's that contrast as well. Roosevelt believed, and later Harry Truman believed at the end of World War II, that they commanded a much greater sense of support. And, you know, not to go too far into the future from where you want to go, but Truman, before he went to the Potsdam Conference, was quite careful to make sure that he had the approval in the U.S. Senate for things like the Bretton Woods Agreement, for the United Nations, that all of that was decided before he went to Europe. And those are things that Woodrow Wilson should have done and did not do. And again, part of it is because he just wasn't a very good politician.
And to expand upon that, he admittedly said that he was disinterested in international affairs, and he said it would be a great tragedy if his administration was known for foreign relations, which of course is hysterical considering we have an entire school of international relations theory named after him or a philosophy. But and he was not at all interested in international relations. You know, he wanted to do domestic issues. He wanted to bring some kind of semblance of what he termed reason and moderation to progressivism. He wanted to continue it on. He was not at all interested in that. So Mike is definitely correct in terms of just, you know, Roosevelt is a much better politician than Wilson is.
And I think you get a clear sense of Wilson's arrogance, too, that he has the answers and therefore compromise weakens the final solution, which, you know, if it works and you actually are right and you actually can convince people of that, then maybe it's the way to go. But, you know, one of the reasons the Treaty of Versailles goes down to the defeat that it goes down to is the Republicans came back to Wilson and some congressional Democrats and said, look, if you can make these changes, we think we've got the votes. And Wilson's response was absolutely not. Absolutely not. There will be no negotiation. There will be no reopening of this, and there will be no compromises. That's the kind of thing. It's really hard to imagine a seasoned, wise, popular politician like someone like Franklin Roosevelt saying, unless it was a principle that he really, really held to.
And I think that some could argue that by that time, obviously his health was failing, but I think you can look earlier in his career, and Wilson always had this elite kind of sense of self and true disdain for compromise and disdain for I think fairly thin skin would be a way to describe him.
Gentlemen, I was wondering if we could kind of tie it all together and sum up, because we've opened up a lot of very interesting avenues here, but I want to kind of bring it all together in that when we're engaging with this question of should the United States have entered the First World War, it isn't just really, though, it seems, a matter of whether or not the United States could have avoided it in April of 1917, that both of you have made some very good arguments for why we couldn't have. But also this idea that, you know, it really does dictate the terms by which the United States is trying to define itself in the world, and it not necessarily in ways that the United States ultimately is comfortable with.
Yeah, I think this has been a debate we've had ever since. I mean, I you know, there's a really good argument to be made that this sets the course of American foreign policy and everything that more or less has come since. And the most recent presidential election brought it out again, where there were two political candidates, one of which was arguing that the United States needs to play a leadership role in international organizations, and the other political candidate who was arguing that we should be doing just the opposite, that we should be free to act unencumbered by international organizations, and we should negotiate with the world on bilateral terms, and that that's not only good for us, that's good for the world. And however one feels about those two arguments and however one feels about those two candidates, it's easy for me to see as an historian where these ideas are coming from, what part of our DNA is being expressed in this. And it comes from the First World War. It comes from this question of whether the United States should operate in the international system like everybody else, or whether the United States should recognize that it is not like everybody else, and whether the United States ought to function in that system in a completely different environment. So to me, you know, the last few years has only validated the importance of studying this war and of doing it at the level of complexity of the war itself, that simple answers are simply not going to work here.
And I absolutely agree. And I think the other dimension, and this is something we haven't really gotten into, but the other dimension is there is still in 1917 an ongoing question about what does it mean to be an American? What is the nature of the country all about? And this, and when you start to think about international affairs, you know, this really comes into play, because it's the question of, okay, whose interests, how do we define American interests? whose interests are those? Are they, you know, this element of society, that element of society? Is everybody bought into the concept of the United States? That's why we get into the anti-German stuff and the 100% American. But, you know, the U.S. is really still in flux. And it's a lot of, and to some, to many degrees, we're still in, because it's still this, how do you create a unified, national identity from this polyglot, this great assortment of disparate groups, and trying to create that, and then trying to create a unified foreign policy, it's incredibly difficult.
That element of national definition is one that is very fascinating, but unfortunately, I think we're going to have to leave it for a future podcast. Michael Nyberg, Brian Newman, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedules to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you.